Welcome to Inside Out, the podcast for and by ISMB and SMNO alumni. It's fantastic to have you listening in today. My name is Sam, a current ISMB student.
And I'm Peter. I'm an ISMB and SMNO lecturer. And today we're going to talk to Dr. Susanne Ryder. Susanne, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Susanne has spent time on the football and hockey fields with a background in gymnastics and fitness too. More recently, she's gotten herself into pro cycling, including carbon fiber frames and Lycra. We're delighted to have you here today, and thanks for being with us in the studio. You're one of the first SMNO students to attain a PhD and currently based in Italy, completing a visiting scholar one-year internship. We thought you'd be a fantastic guest to have on the podcast. We are delighted to have you with us today.
But I want to start with how you got to SMNO, because you didn't take a direct route from high school into the program.
No, I did not.
Tell us what you did.
Yeah, I was 17 when I finished HAFO. And I went to the school market, like all the hochschule and universities were talking like to promote their studies, and actually wanted to do nutrition, but they didn't show up, and SMNO was there. I was like, oh, this is fantastic, let's do that. And I found out you had to do like a sports test and a motivation letter and all these things. I tried it, I got in. But I also wanted to go to the United States to do a high school year. And at the time, I don't know if this is still the thing, the acceptance to the program is valid for a year. Mm-hmm. And I made use of that to say, hey, thanks, but I'll do it next year. And I went to the United States.
So you postponed it for a year, kind of like we were your second option, because you wanted to do footing, but they didn't show up, and then you ended up a year later.
Yep.
And then you went to the US. Where did you go and what did you do?
So I signed up with this organization called Education First, EF, and their philosophy is you just sign up and we'll send you somewhere where we have availability, and it's going to be a unique, great American experience anyway. So I ended up in Mississippi.
Of all places.
Of all places.
What was that like?
Very southern. Mm-hmm. At first, you know, it's very different from Dutch culture. So I was amazed and like, oh yeah, cool cowboy boots and the southern twang and southern food, high schools, and the football team, cheerleaders, you know, all the things from the movies. But I found out soon that things where we are a bit more advanced in the Netherlands in terms of sexism, racism, and religion. We were quite different from my upbringing, and that was troublesome at times. It was a good learning experience.
Yeah.
And whilst you were there, did you feel a privileged sort of European living in a less privileged American state?
At the time I didn't, because I didn't know what privilege was. I was 17. I was just this Dutch girl being the foreigner in the high school, and then that was attractive to a lot of those local students. I remember befriending a group of boys from the music team or something, and just hanging out, and they're like, you know what, you're not white, you're Dutch, you're cool. And I didn't know what that meant. Like, okay, yeah, I am Dutch, and I don't know, am I white? And then, you know, through studies, I was like, ah, that's powerful, or yeah, there's a different understanding of race in that area.
Yeah, so they were looking for ways to categorize you, and now they had to come up with a new category because you didn't fit the boxes that were already present.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, very.
Yeah. And then returning back to the Netherlands after a year, what did this experience provided you that helped you starting on your SMNO journey?
I'm very happy that I did that year, because you know, I was 17 when I finished high school in the Netherlands. So I was 18 when I started SMNO, still very young. But it was a bit more life experience. Mm-hmm. seeing a different country, getting to know different culture, being able to speak English well. I think that just.
Just that extra year of experience and language skills.
And
maturity, perhaps.
Perhaps.
Yeah, sure. Do you still keep in touch with people from your time in Mississippi?
Yeah, one mostly. Everyone's lives have developed differently. Most of them got married very young and mm-hmm. have many children now. And the one that I keep in touch with is unmarried and has no children. So we have more in common.
Sure, yeah.
And she travels more, and the rest, they kind of stay put there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, cool. And now you're entering SMNO. Describe your first year experience.
Yeah. It was great. I really enjoyed the first year, all years of SMNO. In between returning from the US and starting SMNO, I actually got into a relationship, and it wasn't a great relationship. Mm-hmm. So that affected my time in SMNO as a student. I remember very well him saying like, oh, you don't go to college to make friends. You go to college to get an education.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I tried not to make friends. That's not fun.
Yeah.
And
do you feel like you missed any other opportunities due to that relationship holding you back?
I think so, yeah. Because I was very focused on internships in my hometown, because then I could spend more time in the relationship. All my internships have been mostly in Almere. Not to get into a fight about that and the traveling. It helped me back. It helped me back socially and network wise, internship wise. But nonetheless, I did still make friends. I mean,
sure. Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone was very, very, very great at the SMNO. But I do think that, as an 18-year-old, you don't realize what you're in.
Mm-hmm, sure.
So I think that would be something for students that are listening now, like, be critical of your relationships. And
yeah.
Like, I would even go as far to say, like, don't be in a relationship. Okay.
While you're keep your options open.
While you're studying, yeah. Because you're just freer. Yeah. It's just better.
So if you were to go back and have that time again, would that be the advice to yourself?
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if I would listen because I'm very stubborn. But
yeah.
I think, yeah.
And apart from forming meaningful relationships during your studies and growing your network, obviously you're somebody who is also thinking and looking outside of the city of Almere, with all due respect to Almere, of course. Where did that desire to travel and see the world and experience different parts of the world, where did that come from?
That's a good question. I'm just a very curious person.
Okay.
I also like to seize opportunities when I see them. And because I've held back for quite some time taking those opportunities, maybe overcorrecting them mm-hmm. by moving halfway across the world. I also did have a good friend, Jola Brursche, who really encouraged me. So that has helped me too. Like she said, let's go to Finland. Let's go to winter school.
Really?
And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let's do it. And yeah. I just did it. And yeah.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. During SMNO, you started to take some research classes, something that is a big part of your work in life as a PhD. But can you go back to the first research class that you took in SMNO, and what were your impressions, and did you like it or did you dislike it?
I think the first research thing was market research, mm-hmm. and I developed a employee satisfaction survey for the internship that I was doing. And
this is in your second year then?
Yeah, okay. Must have been.
Yeah.
It was like my external.
Right.
External. I don't know.
Yeah, what is
this?
Yeah.
And I like that. I was like, we can measure something, or we can create some knowledge, and then we can move forward, and then based on those results. Mm-hmm. I didn't necessarily like it. Everything was fine. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a passion necessarily for research at the time when I first got introduced to it. I was still finding like what I liked during SMNO. Like I had no clue.
Yeah.
But yeah, that I think that was my first experience with research.
Yeah. And how did that progress to something that you, I'm assuming, kind of liked and actually became really, really good at?
I think this relates to my choice of minor. Mm-hmm. And the third year, I did health and active lifestyle, which was a minor at the time, which was interdisciplinary. I think there was ALO involved and was international as well. And that spoke to me because, you know, I'd done a year in US. I really like international aspect. I didn't like the minor. I didn't feel challenged mm-hmm. at the time. So I was talking to my friend Jora about this. She said, oh, I'm doing the minor at the University of Utrecht. Maybe you should do that. And then I started talking to my mentor at the time, Erik Koning, and then the university minor coordinator, Jan Karel
Bast. Yes.
Bast.
Yeah.
Hey, can I do another minor? Because I want to make the most of my time at college or university. Is this opportunity available? And they said, you know what? If you really want to do it, go for it. Try. So I did another minor at the university.
Was that something you had to do on your own time whilst you were doing the rest of your bachelor's degree?
At the time, I had to take my major courses, I think, and there was actually overlap. I think Henk Hille was teaching organizational something at SMNO, and at the time, I was using the same book at the university minor. And I remember having human resources with Henry de Weerd.
Yep.
And I emailed all of my teachers saying, hey, I'm doing this double thing. Can you not count my absence against me? I will take the tests. I will do the essays. I will do the work. I just can't be in class. And most of them were very accommodating. So I think I graduated with 30 extra credits or something because I did a whole extra minor. That was intense.
Yeah.
But I liked it. I liked the new knowledge that I was learning, which is different type of knowledge and studying to what I was used to. And I was also working at the time and playing hockey, and it was crazy.
Yeah, busy schedule.
Yeah.
You just mentioned Henk Hille, who was teaching you at that time. What was your impression of him back then, and maybe especially how it relates to research?
He taught sports sociology, mm-hmm. which is now major in my life. He was also my graduation supervisor.
Sure.
He was so passionate, and the way he would speak of things, and very helpful and supportive. And I remember we would write our part of our research report, and he would have a marker and a pen, and he would underscribe things and mark them, and he had like the markers in his mouth, and he's like, oh, this is really important.
Really into it.
Really into it, very enthusiastic, very excited. Very, very great figure. yeah. during my studies.
So he left an impression on you.
He did. Yeah, for sure.
Well, the same way for him, you left an impression. So we actually have a nice little clip from Henk. Take a look.
All right.
Hi, Susanna. It's great to hear you're pursuing an international academic career that took you to Utrecht for your master's and to Victoria University in Australia for your PhD. I have fond memories of you and Joa being part of our research group at the Amsterdam University of Applied Sciences. It is flattering to hear that you mentioned both Erik Koning and me as two lecturers that influenced you at the beginning of your journey. I specifically remember you being really impressed with my multicolor feedback.
Oh, yes. Oh, that's great. I
got
love
the
that.
Print, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I think we even bought him some markers.
Did you really?
Yeah, as a thank you.
Oh, wow.
As a thank you gift for supervising us.
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. Thanks.
You're touched by this.
Oh, very touched.
Yeah.
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 So is he, I can tell. He's very proud of you and what he's describing with a lot of pride in his voice is an international academic career.
Yeah.
So that's definitely something to be proud of and that we're proud of because I think you're one of the first PhDs to come out of the program.
Yeah, together with Jora.
She's
like, yeah. I don't know how we pulled this off, but it happened.
Which you did, yeah.
Yeah.
There's another aspect that I wanted to maybe touch upon in developing your international academic career, and that's the power of networking.
Yeah.
Can you tell us the importance of networking and how you're applying your networking skills?
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, I just told about how I started Esminov in this not so great relationship. So I heard Jaap van Hulte always say, networking is important. Go to the SOS network. And I was like, no, I'm not going to do that. But in hindsight, it is really important to create those relationships and, you know, to maintain that and to leave a good impression and yeah, just talk to people and be interested in them. And it really... For me it has paid off, and you don't often realize it at the time, but looking back, the reason that I done my PhD or that I got into my PhD or that I even knew about my PhD was because my professor at University of Utrecht sent me an email saying, "Hey, you might fancy this, an opportunity to do research in Australia." Which has been the country that I've always wanted to go to.
Yeah.
And like for the fact that she thought of me and sent it to me, like that's paid off because I applied and I got it and now I have a different last name.
There you go. Funny how things work.
And a title, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've just mentioned networking is a really important skill. And that's what got you to Victoria University in Australia. But how does that look like for students who are starting SMNO and progressing with their student careers?
I think, the studies, SMNO, ISMB, have a lot of opportunities built in, the internships, the social aspects, there is the SOS. And all the teachers are so approachable and social media, adding them into your network. To me the other day or yesterday, someone had read my chapter and they reached out to me on Twitter like, "Hey, I'm a scholar at this and this university in the US. I'm gonna start a project on this. Do you wanna be involved?" So also having a social media page that is open to that helps. So I think networking is part of you as a person and your capabilities, your interest, your work, and have that shown for it. At the same time, I do think networking is a complex thing because there is a lot of privileges involved. Why do people think of me for a PhD opportunity. Psychologically, people like to help people that look like them or that are similar to them. And for me, that has paid off because I had a professor saying, hey, we want more women doing PhDs. What do you think of this opportunity? There's this opportunity. Let me show you. And then, you know, and then the research group at Victoria University had a Dutch, like the leader of it had a Dutch professor that was the supervisor the graduation supervisor of ULA Bursa. So I sent him an email saying, hey, I see this opportunity. What do I need to do or say that will help me get in? And he said, well, I'll talk to Fiona. And, you know, it's just, it, that helps knowing people. And the sports world, especially sports sociology world, is quite small.
Yeah.
So knowing the people, reaching out to them helps. Just have drop your name somewhere. And that's what I've been doing now. I've just been applying to jobs that to get my name out, even though I probably won't get them because of my geographical location.
Yeah.
But they are informed of my name. But yeah, I also think, you know, having privilege in networking is a thing.
Sure. And one of the things that I came across is your master's thesis. And the title, I have the English translation here, but it doesn't quite do it justice. I like the Dutch version a lot better. Can you maybe recall the title and discuss what you researched for your master's thesis?
Yeah, the the title is a quote from someone I interviewed for the research I done, and it's holy shit, these chicks go just as hard as us. Can I swear in a podcast?
We have an editor, so.
Yeah, and in Dutch, it catches it more. Yeah, I totally hear what you're saying, and yeah, it. Was a qualitative research on gender in CrossFit. During the masters, I was introduced to diversity in sport as a course, where I was taught about able-bodiedness in sport, gender in sport, race in sport, you know, all these topics that, and we went in depth on those topics, and I was like, oh, now I get it. Now I understand what's happening. I mean, more or less. And I found that fascinating, and I wanted to know more, and I started reading about it in my own time, so not necessarily for studying. But with the masters, it's a dual master, so you do courses and an internship for 2 years. And I did my internship at the Wilhelmina Children's Hospital. Okay. In Utrecht, and I, together with Aniek van der Veste, we aim to create a sports program for chronically ill children in the hospital. And when the time came around for master dissertation, I was like, well, maybe I can do something with institutional logics, because, you know, you have the institutional logic of the hospital, which is care, and then you have sports, which is competition usually, and all these norms that are involved, and how does that merge, or how does that conflict in a hospital, you know? Very, very interesting. But at the same time, I was like, does this really interest me? Is this my passion? Do I wanna spend the last half year of my study time on this? And then over Christmas, I was like, yeah, no. I'm more interested in CrossFit, and I'm more interested in gender. So I talked to my supervisor at the uni, Michel Sluba, and he gave me the green light as well, like, okay, you can change your topic. And then I did. And then I did research on gender and CrossFit.
Yeah. And then particularly the perspective on how women experience CrossFit or how hard they go as compared to men?
No, it So I was introduced to this concept called hegemonic masculinity.
Sure.
Just break down for us what hegemonic masculinity actually is, and how do you define it?
It is a dominant form of masculinity that only a few people have, but everyone else is turning to. So that is the norm. And both men and women see that as the norm, and that is everything else is conditioned towards that. So it's the dominant form of masculinity within sports and exercise, physical activity, and we behave towards that norm. And I found that fascinating. And sports are traditionally very masculine dominated, and I looked at CrossFit thinking, oh, this is new. This was only established in the year 2000. Men and women do it. Men and women do the same. They compete, you know, must be equal. And then I was, well, let's explore that idea. And during the master's, I was also introduced to qualitative research, specifically ethnography. I was like, wow, this is cool. This is real research. This is, you know, researching the real world. And I want to do that. So I did CrossFit, gender, and ethnography. And I went to a local gym. It's like, hey, can I do research here? And they were like, well, okay. Sure. And then I looked at, you know, gender performances. Like, we think it's equal, but how? What does it look like in a grassroots gym? Do they do the same? Is there equal appreciation for femininity, masculinity, and all of that? And yeah, that's what I wrote my dissertation on.
And for those of us who don't know what ethnography is as a research method, can you give a brief summary how it's conducted by researchers?
Yeah, simply put, it means that I, as the researcher, am the research instrument. So my lived experiences, by systematically writing down field notes, which then becomes my data, I can say something about the social conditions and social relations, social constructions. And usually it happens through observations, participation, and interviews. So all of that combined, I'm really trying to embed yourself within the field. So for my dissertation, the field of CrossFit, the field of a local CrossFit gym, where I then observe and participate, and I did interviews.
And how do you account for your own personal biases?
Yeah, that's a great question. That's part of the research, because every researcher has biases, you know. The choice of theory, the choice of point of view, the truth, like how you construct your truth, is a bias. It's a choice. Like either you choose, you know, there's so many choices of how to do research, and that is a bias. So I incorporate my identity, like I'm a white, cis, heterosexual woman looking at the world, looking at this CrossFit gym, and that will impact my results. So as a reader, you need to understand that as well, that is a bias, and that does affect the world, but we all are affected differently, and you know that is accounted for.
After learning more about hegemonic masculinity, did that change your views upon how it played out within the sports industry?
That's interesting. And you know, I like sports. And that's kind of a troublesome relationship, right? Like, I like it, but I also see the negatives, and I'm critical of that. And I still like to do CrossFit. I still like the workouts, and but yeah, learning about those things, I am more critical of the reality that I find myself in a sports setting. Like, oh, the first time I learned about hegemonic masculinity and what it looks like in sports, I still played hockey. And I was so more aware of what the coach was doing and how he was just through words and through acting towards us, I was like, man, this is not good. This is, now I understand why I don't like this, because I have words for it. I found a language for it. So I was able to go against it better because I understood it better. Wasn't always appreciated.
Yeah. So apart from coming up with some interesting findings in your master's thesis, there were also things that maybe changed in your personal life because you saw the world a little bit better. And what you said, you were able to put words to some of the things that you observed.
Yeah.
And how did you take that experience to Victoria in pursuing your PhD? You already mentioned kind of like how your networking skills got you there.
Yeah.
But then you enter the program and you start up another research project. Can you take us through those steps?
Yeah. After my master's, I worked as a barista because I was done studying. I was like, because the relationship ended and I had to do, it was a intense time, and I was like, I want to do something easy. Let's be a barista. And I'm not saying that that's super easy because my latte art sucked. And so I did a lot of CrossFit. I did a lot of coffee making. And after 3 months, I was like, I need to use my brain in a different way. And then the opportunity came along to apply for the PhD, and I found out late 2016 that I got it. And then you have to apply for a visa and, you know, just hold your life in Amsterdam and try to find something in Australia. So I got there in July 2017 at Victoria University with the Sport, Diversity and Social Change group. And yeah, I started a research project on professional women's road cycling using ethnography.
Can I just ask, so when you arrived into Australia, was it a smooth transition or did you find yourself in a whirlwind?
No, this was smooth. That's again privilege and network. My best friend Julieta met someone during her travels who lived in Melbourne, Australia, and they have Dutch heritage, and so the mom loved her. They kept in touch. When we found out I was going to Australia, she contacted the mom, Sue Donkers. Shout out to her. And my friend was like, can my friend stay with you? She's doing a PhD. She doesn't have a place to stay. And the mom was like, yes. So I stayed with them for a month.
Oh, wow.
And yeah, and she became like my Australian mom. Yeah.
Wow. So the power of network. Yeah.
Yeah. Once again.
And so starting your PhD, did you immediately start with ethnography as a research method, or what was your timeline?
Yeah, with Victoria University, the first half year of your research, of your PhD, you do two courses, ethics of research and making a research plan. So literature review and kind of teaching you how to do that. But I actually did start the ethnography right away because I talked to my supervisors, Fiona McLaughlin and Brett McDonald, like, okay, like how shall we go about this ethnography thing? I said, well, if you can find a bike and you want to join a club, go for it and just write about it. So I was trying to do CrossFit over there because that's what I knew. I said, hey, anyone have a bike? And there was Sarah. She was like, I have a bike, you can buy it. So I bought this third hand racing bike. It was the first road bike I ever owned, you know, with the drop bars and the clip pins, and I had to wear lycra and like intense. But yeah. And then how do you find your way in competitive cycling? That was the big question of the first year, like, how do I get into this sport? That was tricky.
Did you start competing or did you join others or how did that go?
It was a gradual process because, you know, coming from a hockey background, like I turned to clubs. You know, you join a club, you play hockey.
Yeah.
And with cycling, there were clubs. But Melbourne's a big city. I didn't know the city yet, so I didn't know how far things were. You had to really get a feel for it. And most clubs were like, well, maybe you should ride your bike first and then you can join the club. I was like, yeah, but I need someone to show me how to ride my bike. Like, where do I go? What's safe? How do I get better at bike riding? So that was kind of this tension, like, how do I get into this? And then there was a Facebook group promoting women's racing. And they had actual real life meetings, like, let's gather, let's talk about this. How do we do this? I went there, I talked to someone, and I was like, I'm trying to get into cycling. Can I cycle with you? And she was like, yeah, I'll show you. And then I joined the club, and then I started racing. Yeah. So networking.
Yep. So you got into the culture of cycling, right? You became an active cyclist, keeping notes along the way.
Yep.
At what point do your notes turn into data, and do you kind of find your way? Okay, this is the issue, or this is the topic that I really want to research.
That's a good question. The field notes are different for every ethnographer, I think. And some ethnographers have like two data sets, where one, they describe kind of their objective. I mean, it's not a good word, but mm-hmm. like what has happened, what have they done, what time, how many people were there, those kind of details. And then on the other hand, they have like, how did I feel? What did I do? Like, was I intimidated? Was I happy? Was it like more of the subjective, as we were saying earlier? I kind of merged them because I think they're just so inherent to what has happened. How did I feel? And how did that impact, the situation, the context? And when it becomes data is when I start analyzing it.
So you've bought your bike, you've joined a club, you've got your Lycra.
Yes.
You're well on your journey into ethnography and your research with the cycling. Where did this journey then take you?
For my research, I had three main methods, which was participation in a local setting. So what I set out to do with my research is understand the pathway, the journey of a women cyclist from starting to the top. So the participation part was like, how do you get into it? How do you stay in it? Then I looked at national races and regional races, and I interviewed elite Australian cyclists. And then I went to Europe. So I came back to Europe to follow the world tour, the women's world tour, to do observations, which is kind of like participatory observations. Not that I now was a world tour cyclist, but I participated as like in the field. I was with the jury. I was with the organization. I was with in the team cars. I was with the cyclists. I was having breakfast with them. I was having dinner with them. I was at their briefings, their debriefings. Which is more than, you know, being a fly on the wall and just looking. But I was really within the field, within the actors, as we say in social science. So
so you were able to develop personal relationships with the cyclists and really get a feel for what they went through and what they experienced during their time on their tour through Europe.
Yeah, that was the aim. Of course, it is. I will never know what an actual professional women cyclist goes through, but I did it as best as I could.
Yeah. And of this entire experience, what were some of the maybe toughest moments? Because I can imagine it's not always easy to be more than a fly on the wall, but not being an actual participant.
Yeah. So how I did this is my family helped me with a camper van. I got this Hyundai H200 red We called her Scarlett Johansson. and I literally followed the world tour. Like, I drove from the Netherlands to Belgium, France, Basque Country in Spain, England. I took the ferry. I went to Italy. And it's that, you know, unique experience. Great. And it was very lonely as well. I remember one time in Italy, they done the time trial of the Giro Rosa, and they're like, okay, we're off to the next hotel, and everyone was gone, and I was still there with my van. I was like, now I have to find a place to sleep again, and I have to, you know, find food and all those basic things that you take for granted living in a house, like a clean bathroom. Yeah. So yeah, and when I started was in March in Ghent, where I was on Monday. It was freezing, and then in July I was in Italy with the Giro Rosa, and it was so hot, and there were mosquitoes everywhere. So that was pretty hard. Yeah. That was a challenge.
So for 4 months you were on the road,
seven months.
Ended up 7 months.
Yeah.
And so they were some of the harsh realities that you faced. Can you talk about the riders, and maybe what were some of the realities about being a pro cyclist on the tour?
Yeah. For the Giro Rosa, for many races, really, it's cycling is hard, and racing at that level is even harder. I can't imagine. But there's not the same kind of facilities that you would have as a basketball player or as a football player. You know, you have to then sit for hours in a car being stinky, driving to the next location, eating, and you know, some of these teams they don't have the big coach buses. You know, they don't have proper food. So like one of the soigneurs would make rice at 12 at night for the riders then to just eat rice while they're driving to the next stage, you know, or they would get pots and pans as prizes, or if they, you know, got a prize at all. Those are some of the, and then, you know, we talk about professionalization of women's sport a lot, which we view as progression in some ways that is, but at the same time at what cost, because the sponsors that might choose to sponsor races, a cycling race, do this from the masculine point of view, where they will have sexualized images of women, or they have infantilized images where, you know, for the Giro Rosa, there was one stage where they used a squirrel to promote the race. Like a lady squirrel.
A lady squirrel, like.
Yeah, like with eyelashes and like pink clothes. And I'm like, yeah, this is a World Tour race. These are proper athletes. And we're using a squirrel.
And so there is still the presence of hegemonic masculinity in the midst of this pro women's European tour event.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
And we talk a lot about the power of sport, and we're very positive about the benefits that it brings. Would you say there is, we can evaluate this from the other point of view? And
yeah, I see the power of sport is in existence. Right. I mean, we've all benefited from it. That's why we're here. But I think it is important to realize why it has benefited us specifically and why it doesn't benefit everyone. And that's kind of what I'm trying to do with my research, look critically at that. And hopefully one day we can contribute and reach that point where everyone can enjoy the power of sport.
So reaching out to the current SNO students, perhaps that someday may be on that path, on the journey that you're on, one of the advices I'm sure that you have is you know, build those relationships while you're at the university. Any other words of wisdom or pieces of advice that you would like to share with them?
Yeah, I do have a quote. My friend gave this to me from Kyoko Escamilla. And it's about, you know, being in your 20s, being young. And I'll just read it out. Your 20s are your selfish years. It's a decade to immerse yourself in every single thing possible. Be selfish with your time and all the aspects of you. Tinker with shit, travel, explore. Love a lot and love a little and never touch the ground. And I thought that was just an amazing quote. You know, being young, making the most of it. You know, it doesn't stop when you start getting older. You know, never touch the ground.
Yeah. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Wonderful quote. We should put up on the wall somewhere.
I think.
Awesome.
So we're almost at the end of the podcast. Susanna, can I ask you about if there is anything that you wish you'd done more, or if you could go back again, what would you like to try?
Looking back at what I've achieved, I see those as successes, and it's worked out well for me. I've had many opportunities that I've accepted and taken on. Also, not always taken risks because of a fear of failure. And now, looking back, I think failure would have been very valuable. Failure would have been very valuable because that experience makes you stronger, more confident. If you have the balance of success and failure and can get out of it. But I think, yeah, as another advice to students, don't be afraid of failure, because it is so valuable and it teaches you so much about yourself and it puts you stronger in your shoes.
Amazing. Yeah. And looking ahead then, do you have any dreams or aspirations for the future?
Yeah, you asked me this question, I think, in the pre-interview. I think I would like to be in a play. That's what my answer was, like being in a musical or something, do something completely different. But to stay within what I'm doing, I would like to start more of like a sport feminist platform, maybe a podcast, maybe a blog, maybe a social media page. So if there's any students out there who are interested to do that with me, send me an email, send me a message. Because I think in the Netherlands, there is a lot of, you know, critical platforms with gender and feminism, but not so much with sports yet. And I think I would like to start that more.
Sounds like a wonderful ambition. Susanna, thank you so much for taking the time and energy to be part of this podcast, the Inside Out podcast, where we look back to who you were and we look forward to who you want to become.
We hope you are able to relate to Susanna's story and take some inspiration from it. If you have any lingering thoughts, please get in touch. Make sure to follow the Inside Out podcast on Spotify to be sure not to miss out on any further episodes. Until next time.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.